This is part one in a two-part series. This series contains discussion of violence and sexual violence against children, of crime scenes, and of sexual assault. Listener discretion is advised. First, a note about name usage in this series. In January of 2021, Angel, Georgia's sister and advocate, discovered that Georgia's birth name was Georgia Leah Moses, not Georgia Lee Moses. Georgia's case has been publicized under the name Georgia Lee Moses for years, and much of the work Angel has begun uses the name Lee in its social media branding. The story of this discovery is complex, and the systems that failed Georgia in life have become more apparent as those seeking justice in her case continue their work. Georgia's family will eventually speak out about this development via their own social channels. For now, they express their desire to continue the momentum of the use of the hashtag #JusticeForGeorgiaLeeMoses. They'll now add an additional hashtag, #GeorgiaLeahMoses, to honor Georgia's identity. Follow their social media, linked in the show notes, for more info. Please stay tuned through the end of the episode. We have two announcements concerning virtual events that we're taking part in on February 20th. One to benefit the Charlie Project, and one to help fund the billboard that announces the Millbrook Twins reward. This is The Fall Line. On the outskirts of Petaluma, California, there was an angel. Made of steel and anchored to the earth with concrete, it stood watch. Around it grew a little oasis. Flowers, verdant plants with no obvious water source. Incongruous with attractive road like Petaluma South. The memorial garden was planted near the on-ramp of Highway 101. Two local firemen built that statue to honor a Santa Rosa child, Georgia Moses, whose body was discovered in that spot back in August of 1997. She wasn't immediately recognized as such. The earliest report from the Argus Courier said that, quote, "The badly decomposed body of a woman was found under a pine tree at the end of Petaluma Boulevard South. Her remains were found by a city worker who was out to repair a broken guardrail." Per the Courier, the victim was described as a Black female, about 5'4" and 120 pounds. She had long hair worn in cornrows. The earliest reports didn't specify this, but she was also nude. She'd been sexually assaulted. Her cause of death would later be determined as strangulation. There was no identification found with the victim's body. It would eventually be discovered that a 12-year-old girl, Georgia Moses, had gone missing on August 13th. The last person to see her was a friend who's never been named in the media. Georgia was then linked with the body that was found off Petaluma Boulevard South. Authorities weren't sure how Georgia had made it all the way out to Highway 101. She certainly hadn't gone on foot. A Santa Rosa police sergeant told the Sacramento Bee, quote, "That's not a place where someone her age would normally be walking. It was not an area suited to foot traffic." Though Georgia usually lived with her mother and her younger sister, that hadn't been the case in the months preceding her death. There were issues with her mother's boyfriend, and Georgia had been staying with a friend of the family. Though she wasn't living with her mother and sister, she still saw them often. In fact, Georgia came by every day to see 7-year-old Angel. She played with her sister, checked on her, quote, "braided my hair," as Angel told NBC News. Georgia continued to care for Angel in the 100 little ways she always had. After all, they were incredibly close. This was the same older sister who taught Angel to tie her shoes, checked on her at nap time, and fixed her snacks. But at that time in their lives, it was best for Georgia to be with other caregivers. On the night of August 13th, Georgia spent time with the friend we'd mentioned, the one who saw her last. Per NBC, that same friend reported to authorities that Georgia had received an alert on her pager that night. Georgia then made a call, and pretty soon after, she wanted to walk up to a local gas station. NBC reported, quote, "Sometime later, the friend walked with Georgia to a gas station near the intersection of Sebastopol Road and Dutton Avenue in Santa Rosa, where the friend said Georgia left with an unidentified male." Georgia's friend was able to give a description of the man to police, and a sketch was eventually circulated. Per the Courier, he was, quote, "a black male, 25 to 30 years old, 6'2" to 6'4", and about 200 pounds, with closely cropped hair, a medium complexion, and a slight mustache. His car was described as, quote, "a small white four-door vehicle." The article's headline described this man as a suspect. Although this is certainly the night that she disappeared, Georgia would not be reported missing for over a week. The circumstances there are complex. Her mother believed that she was with a family friend, and because Georgia wasn't living at home, her mother didn't know of her absence. Georgia Moses was eventually reported missing, but on the same day that her body was recovered. Likely, by the time that first article appeared, authorities were already connecting the cases, realizing that they'd found a child, not a woman, underneath that pine, and the trail would be a week or more cold. A September Argus Courier article mentioned the existence of a, quote, "Georgia Lee Moses hotline." It was the same article that gave the suspect description, and it appeared close to a month after Georgia's murder. By that time, locals had begun to leave flowers and stuffed animals out near Highway 101, where her body was found. Then the bouquets made way for plants, things that would grow and not wither. This gesture would eventually transform into a memorial garden, where the angel statue would later stand. Within a month of the discovery of Georgia's body, locals had begun expressing concern regarding the lack of national coverage of her case. There was also worry that her murderer had not been caught. In a September 8th article titled "Slain Girl Not Forgotten," Marie DeSantis, executive director of Sonoma's chapter of Women Against Rape, spoke with reporters. Her organization had participated in a September 1997 memorial for Georgia, which had drawn about 30 people. Quote, "People are real concerned this death hasn't had an answer. They are very disturbed this little girl was killed," she said. Her group worked to keep the memorial garden going, to keep watch. There was no formal system in place to tend it. It would be a volunteer effort. A few years after Georgia's murder, in 2000, a larger ceremony was held. The garden still stood, tended by locals. At that time, close to 200 people attended the dedication of the statue that bore her name. According to the Petaluma Argus Courier, Georgia's friends were there to remember her. She was described by them as athletic and outgoing and fun. The statue replaced a birdbath, which had been stolen from the garden sometime before. The statue's concrete anchoring made certain that this time, Georgia's memorial would be secure. Georgia's story didn't make the national news. In fact, it barely left the confines of Sonoma County. It was a stark contrast, because a few years earlier, Polly Klass had been murdered in the same town. She was also 12, just like Georgia. Polly's story made national headlines, international headlines. Georgia, she had her angel, but no resolution, no answers. It could be argued, it's clear, that in life, Georgia Leah Moses was failed by every system that crossed her path. Child Protective Services, possibly mandated reporters, certainly the national media machine, which could have signal-boosted her case across the country, as it had with Polly Klass. That sentiment is where most versions of this story stop. Georgia Moses, overshadowed, ignored, made representative of all the things our country has done poorly or not done at all. few articles go further than the surface. Georgia is left as a symbol of the forgotten. But Georgia Moses' case is not forgotten. Justice has no expiration date. At least, that's what another angel tells us. The one who watches over Georgia now. Angel Turner, Georgia's little sister. Angel is not interested in shallow and often inaccurate versions of her sister's life. She's been reading those for decades. She is very aware of what Georgia has not received, what she should have received. Angel was just 7 years old when Georgia was murdered. By the time that statue was erected, Angel had moved to the southeastern U.S. to live with a relative. And when that statue was moved, she was in the military and far from Petaluma. Since the 2012 construction near Highway 101, Georgia's garden is no more, not as it was. Per the Courier, her angel statue has been moved over to the grounds of City Hall, and it now sits nestled underneath another tree, near pedestrian sidewalks, accessible to those who want to come and see it and remember. Angel lives in Texas now with her husband and her children. She's 31 years old. And now, when Angel flies home into Petaluma to see that statue, she's a grown woman coming back to her hometown. And she's on a mission. See, for Angel and for her supporters, Georgia's story is not past tense. Angel is interested in what can happen now. In fact, with help from her friend and family advocate, Maria, she's begun to work the case herself. In the late 1990s, the reward for Georgia's case reached at least $15,000. Maybe it wasn't enough to bring forth the tips that would solve the crime, at least back then. Or maybe people will be more willing to talk now that time has passed. Either way, Angel plans to find out. Angel's mission is twofold. First, she wants to tell Georgia's story the way that she feels it should have been told all along. Not as a cautionary tale, not a story full of victim blaming, but an accurate account of a beautiful soul who cared for her baby sister and was loved by many. A 12-year-old who deserved the support that she didn't get. A child whose case can be solved. Angel's second goal is simple, to solve Georgia's murder and to hold her sister's killer accountable. Over this miniseries, you'll hear about it all from Angel. She's the person who should have been listened to all along. Angel doesn't want to simplify the failures in Georgia's case down to a single issue because there were many factors that affected Georgia. Structural systems like racism and classism, and major failures from governmental agencies like Child Protective Services, lack of access to mental health care for their mother, disinterested media, issues with the investigation. According to Angel, there is no one factor. All of these pieces intersect. And this next bit is vital. Angel says that she doesn't begrudge the coverage Polyclass and other children have received. In her mind, that's absolutely the wrong response to a problem this big. So, what should we be doing instead? Angel asks that every child, every person, gets the same kind of coverage that Polly did and the same passion toward closing their cases. But even more important are the things that can be done before there's a case at all. Georgia Moses' life could have been saved, and she could have been safe. Angel, Brooke, and Angel's friend Maria sat down for a virtual interview on January 8th, 2021. The night before, on the 7th, Angel and others involved in the Justice for Georgia Lee Moses movement had come together to remember Georgia in Petaluma. It was Georgia's 36th birthday. This event came just a few months after a candlelight vigil held in November of 2020, one that was the beginning of a new push for justice in Georgia's case. Angel, 5 years younger than Georgia, spent her early life looking up to her sister and basking in Georgia's care. She talked to us about some of her earliest memories of their relationship.
When I was younger, we played outside a lot. We live in an apartment complex that was fairly large. So my sister would walk me to the playground, which was kind of in the center of the neighborhood. She would walk me there. She would walk me to the gas station that was across the street. And then my mom had a few friends that probably lived no more than 5 minutes from us. So we basically would walk everywhere. And if I was good, she would walk me to get candy. She would just walk me everywhere. You know, I did have a few, you know, I would play with some of my friends, but most of my life consisted of her taking me places. If we were at home, you know, she was doing my hair or dancing. She loved to dance. And so we always just had a really good time together. My school was fairly far. Sometimes my mom would walk me, but mostly she would take me. We lived before we moved to Roanoke Park. There was this train track. And, you know, I just remember it still be kind of dark. And we would walk over the train track. And she would be like, all right, you better be good. And I'm like, ugh. You know, I felt like she always wanted me to be good. And I was just like, I'm always good. But she would always reiterate for me to be good. So, you know, I guess I have to be good.
Can you describe physically how you saw her as a little girl?
So Georgia was, I feel like she was like me, but older, you know, like in hindsight, whenever I looked at her, I saw myself. And I think because I admired her so much. So like there was a situation where we went swimming and I had fell out the tube and I felt like I was drowning. And I was like, I can't swim. And she's like, yes, you can swim. And I was like, I can't. And I was like, I'm drowning. But I'm, you know, yelling to her to help me. And she was like, she stood on the concrete and I could just see in her face that she believed that I could do it. And so she was just like, paddle like this. And so she motioned the doggy paddle. And she said, just keep your head above the water, you know, and something in me and looking at her started to believe that I could. And so I paddled to her and I got out the pool and she's like, see, I told you can do it. And like, you know, she hugged me and she's like, you want to go? And I was like, no, I want to go swimming. And so I jumped back in. And from then on, I loved swimming, you know? And so she had so much power. And the person that she was, where even in the midst of me thinking that I was drowning, she was still able to save me, you know?
Can you talk about other ways that she may have protected you when you were at home?
So there was a situation. I was riding a bike and I was trying to be cool. So I stood up on the bar and I was trying to be cool for a boy. And instantly the bike like did like a little U-turn and I scraped my knee and I scraped my elbow. I just started screaming. And so my sister runs out and she's like, what's wrong? And I was like, I hurt myself. And immediately she wanted to know why I was in that situation, because obviously I knew how to ride a bike. And, you know, like I was a pretty, you know, adventurous. And I rarely hurt myself. So she was just like, how did this even happen? I told her. And so she stood back and she was like, so you got hurt trying to look cute for a boy? And so she just stood there and crossed her arms. And I'm just crying and sobbing. And so then she, you know, took me in and hugged me. And she's like, don't do that again. Like, use your brain. And so I looked at the boy and I looked at my bike and I got back on my bike and I just started riding it normal, you know? One of my first memories, and I don't even know how old I was her pushing me on the swing. Like I said, she was always active with me. And I guess, like, she treated me like I could always do it. It's just amazing when you look at your memories, like what's so profound to you. She was still cognitive of me having a good time, you know, like, okay, it's about you, you know, and it's just, you know, she was special. You know, I really wish I could, you know, bring her back so the whole world could just meet her, because she just really, she loved life and she did her best to ensure that we had a good life, you know. And she always would do my hair. She took time to just braid it and put little bows on it. I remember one time she had made, we would eat hot dogs and eggs. And she was cooking on the stove and she's like, well, what do you want? And I was like, hot dogs and eggs. And she was like, okay. And so she made it. And for some reason, I didn't want it. But she was just like, I've already made it. You're not going to eat it? And I was just like, no. But she's like, well, fine, I'll eat it. And in that, you know, I decided I wanted it. But, you know, she's even like, I look at myself at her age and I'm like, man, like I would get upset off of certain things that my little sibling would do. You know, like you just took time to cook something, like, no, you're going to eat it. Like just being mean, you know, but she rarely, I don't think I ever remember her getting upset with me. Like she had so much patience for me, you know, and she didn't have to. I actually hold my daughters to her standard. You know, like my daughters go at it all day, every day. And I'm like, my sister would not treat your sister how you're treating her. You know, like, you know, and kids are kids, you know, but I just, she was like the perfect blend of parent and sister. You know, like I valued her as a sister, but I needed her as a parent, and she filled both shoes.
So she was definitely wanting to make sure you were safe.
Mm-hmm. Nobody ever messed with me, you know. Her presence was always there.
Georgia and Angel were sometimes in the state's care and had intermittent interactions with Child Protective Services. Their situation was never very clearly or well described in those news reports. So we asked Angel how she wanted to explain their childhood and their home life in her own words.
My mom, she has bipolar schizophrenia. And like just looking back at my childhood during that time, there's a lot of times where mentally she just wasn't there. You know, like right now, me and my mom have a beautiful relationship. You know, she's on medication. She gives me a lot of tokens of life. And I'm just like kind of confused as to how different it was, you know, in the time that has passed. But Child Protective Services is in place for a reason. And I can recall specifically like three encounters where me and my sister were taken from my mom and placed in a group home. There was one main group home at the time. And like whenever we would show up, they'd be like, oh, hey, like it was like a familiar area because we always would return. And so in looking back, I really wonder why they kept returning us to my mom and why they didn't keep us away. You know, I love my mom and I don't take anything from her, but I do know that at that point in time, mentally, she wasn't in a place to raise us. So to be so close to freedom, as far as being in a safe place, yet to have it yanked back when they put us back in her care, is just confusing to me. You know, because obviously there was something she was showing that said she wasn't stable enough. And then now being grown and seeing the amount of cases that the CPS fails to intercede on and how they also end in similar situations as my sister, it lets me know that the problem is the system. You know, there's been multiple cases where kids should not have returned home, and because they did, they wind up not surviving.
So the one constant, steady person in Angel's life was Georgia, though she was a child too. She structured her life around meeting Angel's needs. George's needs were likely not being met, though systems like CPS had been involved for some time. To our knowledge, there was some official awareness that Georgia was caring for a small child. There were flags and signs, checks initiated but not followed through. So Georgia and Angel kept going. Angel talked to us about Georgia's life outside the family. Despite the inaccurate picture painted by some sources, Georgia had many good friends, classmates, and lots of others who cared for her. She spent more time with them as she inched closer to adolescence, but Georgia was still not an average older sister.
So even in her growing up and, you know, hanging out with her friends, she still made sure that I was still a priority. You know, she spent the night a few weeks before she passed, and she was like, okay, you know, the next morning she had to get back to come check on me. You know, so she prioritized making sure that she knew that I was okay. And I was aware of that.
But it was still hard because Georgia was spending more and more time away from home. She was staying with school friends and family friends, often for days or weeks, and coming to check on her little sister in the mornings. The home she shared with her sister and her mother and her mother's boyfriend, it wasn't a safe place for her. According to Angel, it was that spring, maybe 4 or 5 months before George's death, that things had gotten really bad.
So did you have conversations with Georgia about the boyfriend being in the house?
So, yes. So back in, I would say, March, she actually was kicked out of the house by him. So she had just made her some food, some hot dogs and eggs. And she went into her room and he followed her into it. And I think I was on the couch so I could like see that area. But I remember the lock turning and like not even a few seconds later, like I hear a lot of commotion, like my sister's, you know, yelling, no, stop. And immediately he comes back out and he yells at her and he's like, well, if you're not going to listen and follow my rules, then you can't stay here. Which, you know, it wasn't even his place. It was my mom's place. And so she left. And after that, she just started living with friends and, friends of the family. And I remember, I think I was just so paralyzed as to the fact that I saw my sister in a manner I'd never seen her in. Because she was like upset. And walking into the room, there was a splatter of mustard all over the wall from where she threw her plate. And so she hugged me and she kissed me. And she's like, I can't stay here. And so she left. But even in her leaving, she still returned to see me. You know, so she didn't live at the house, but she still would come back to see me and to check on me and to play with me and take me to the park.
Even knowing that she was going to have to face him.
Right.
This is why George's mother hadn't reported her missing. She'd been staying with friends for months. That's another thing that wasn't made clear in the early news coverage of George's case, as Angel told us.
And I can say that about my mom. My mom was in and out, but, you know, she did love us. She didn't know, but she thought my sister was somewhere safe, you know, someone that she trusted. So that's why she didn't report her missing. It's those key moments. It's like she didn't know about, or she felt like we're okay, you know.
Still, when Georgia stopped showing up that mid-August, Angel was sure that something wasn't right. She knew that her sister would never have gone so long without visiting. But it took authorities showing up at the family's door, about something else entirely, for Angel to be able to report that worry. You'll need some important context for what's coming next. According to various news reports, Georgia and Angel's mother was dating a man who'd been convicted of sexual crimes against children. That's why CPS had come to visit their home. That visit was when Angel first spoke to someone about her sister's absence.
Basically, the police that came to our house to do a health, I think, a welfare check, because they had information that there was a pedophile living in our house. And I remember them asking about that person who was my mom's boyfriend at the time. And they asked me, you know, about him. And from my understanding, that's why I was taken from the house, because that was the last time I lived with my mom. But in the midst of them questioning me, I asked them if they'd seen my sister, because I hadn't seen her in a while. And so they, you know, asked a few questions about when's the last time we saw her, you know, whatever, whatever. But I was more concerned about my sister's whereabouts, because I knew that she wouldn't not come check on me in the amount of time that it had passed. And so I wind up, I guess, causing them to, or making them do a missing persons report on my sister. Not ironically, but it's been said that same day that her body was found in Petaluma. So they were able to, I guess, run the missing person report on that person and figure out that it was my sister.
So that was the first report filed for her, your 7-year-old report?
Correct.
You were the first one, and you're still the one. I'm curious to know if you knew the history of the boyfriend that was living in your house at that time before the police brought it up to you.
So I knew he was a pedophile, and that's just from my own personal experience. But I know my mom didn't know. I actually spoke with my mom a few years ago, and, you know, I just asked her, you know, just a healing process, and she didn't know. And I know people are like, well, how do you not know? But in hindsight, there was really no way she would have known, you know. You know, people that are like that, they have a way of covering their tracks. And so I feel like he definitely did that. But I knew, but I didn't know it was a problem. So that's one of the reasons why I think I was just kind of like irritated when the police came, because they kept questioning about him. And, you know, I'm like, but what about my sister? You know, like, my sister hasn't been here, and that's not like her, you know? So to me, it was more of a priority that my sister hadn't shown up and however many days had passed, opposed to them trying to ask questions about a convicted sex offender.
So if I'm understanding correctly, he had been abusing you at the time. And when the police came to question you about that, did you give them direct answers that would implicate him in abusing you?
Yes.
So that's what prompted them to take you from the home?
Correct.
Do you know, did they take you that day?
Yes. And I also like to add that the DA, they came in August, but apparently they were supposed to come in April. They had word somehow of suspicions of a convicted sex offender living with us. They failed to move at that point. And so for whatever reason, I don't know how they knew or whatever, but they came again in August. It is ironic that this time that they came, it was the right time in a sense, because, you know, if they hadn't come, I don't know if I would have, you know, picked up a phone and called the police department, you know, or like, I don't know how much more time would have been lapsed in me not knowing where my sister was or who I would have reached out to try and find her.
It's also, to me, it seems like another case for this specific department being too late. Not only too late for Georgia, but also too late for you.
Per the Argus Courier, Georgia's mother's boyfriend was, quote, a convicted child molester, and his apartment was searched by police, but they would not say if he was named a suspect, end quote. As far as she remembers, Angel had never been asked to testify in any court case. Brooke asked Angel and Maria, her friend and the family's advocate, what happened to her mother's boyfriend.
I want to say he's deceased. One of my friends said that she thought he was deceased off of, like, looking him up. But last I knew, he was still living in the area.
A record that I looked up a few months ago didn't mention him being dead, but it did mention at one point that he was in jail for a long time, so I'm not sure.
We also looked him up, but we were not able to confirm his current status. Brooke and Angel spoke about what happened after Angel talked to authorities about George's disappearance. If you'll recall, Angel was removed from her home that very day.
So, yes, the last time I was placed in the group home was after I was taken from my house because Georgia was missing. When I was at the group home, the first thing I did was look for my sister because we will always be together. And so I would constantly ask the adults, like, where's my sister? She's not here. Where's Georgia? Where's Georgia? And I remember specifically we were taking a car ride somewhere and this song came on, which was I'll Be Missing You. And it just made me think of Georgia because I was like, man, like, I don't think I really could perceive time as far as, like, you know, a month or 2 months or, but I knew enough time had passed that I hadn't seen her. And so it made me think about her because I'm just like, man, like, you haven't shown up yet. Like, where are you at?
Can you tell us when you got the news?
Yes. So I remember it was a sunny day. I was outside. The group home had an outdoor playground that we would play in. I was outside playing with one of my friends and one of the adults came to get me. They told me that I need to go to the office. I kind of, you know, tried to fight it off because I was having a good time. They told me that it was important and that I had to go. And so they walked me to the office and one of the other adults is sitting at the desk and she's like, hey, take a seat. And I was like, I don't want to take a seat. And she's like, I have something important to tell you. I said, okay, well, tell me. Because I was just trying to hurry up to go back outside. And she's like, we found your sister. And I said, okay, well, where is she? You know, I'm like looking around, like, where is she? And they're like, she's gone. And it's like, what do you mean she's gone? You know, they're like, she's dead. And I was like, no, she's not dead. Like, you don't know what you're talking about, you know. And the lady looked at me and she said, no, Georgia's gone. They had to use her dental records to identify her. I knew enough to know what dental records were. And to me, it didn't make sense, you know, because my family, dental hygiene wasn't a big thing, you know, so my mom didn't just take us to the dentist every other, you know, 6 months. So in hearing that, it didn't make sense. And so I was just like, no, we don't even have dental records. And she's like, no, Georgia's gone. And something in the way she said it that next time, even though I couldn't fully understand it, I knew that something about what she was saying was truthful. And so we kind of just stood there for a few minutes and she was like, so what do you want to do? I was like, I want to go to my room because at that point, I didn't want to go back outside. So the guy, he walked me to my room which was empty because everybody was outside. And he was like, is there anybody you want me to send in? And so I asked for the friend that I was playing with. And he was like, she can't come because she's playing right now. So I was like, I'll just stay by myself. So he left. And there I was to process my sister not being here.
It's pretty advanced and really uncalled for, even bordering unhealthy, to tell a 7-year-old details like that.
Yeah, actually, she told me that they found her body and it was so badly decomposed that they had to use her dental records. Which I didn't understand what that meant. I didn't understand that.
What is yeah, to a 7-year-old, what is decomposed? What is that?
And it seems to me that the people who gave you this information about Georgia didn't, it doesn't sound like they had a relationship with you.
No, but I knew them because, like I said, I had been there multiple times. So I knew these people, you know, they knew me, they knew my sister. But that compassion, that sensitivity, you know, like I imagine, because I have a 7-year-old, I just can't imagine somebody sharing that type of news with her. It's inappropriate. It's insensitive.
You were a baby and they delivered this news with such coldness and then took you to your room and just left you there?
Just a system failure coming from every direction.
Angel was in shock. It's not surprising, considering how she was given the news of George's death and the absolute lack of counseling or compassion or support she received. George's funeral was held soon after, and Angel's memories of that time are hazy, blurred by grief and trauma that she experienced. Here's what Angel told Brooke about what she remembers.
At this point, I still didn't believe that she was dead. I think more so because, like, I never witnessed death. So it wasn't a fathomable idea. On top of the fact that I was so close to my sister. So the first funeral was closed casket. And they had like a big old picture of her. And I kept asking like why it was closed. Because I wanted to see my sister. You know, like, let me see her. And they told me that, no, like, she looks too bad. We got to keep it closed. And so a part of me kind of just felt like everybody was lying, you know, like it didn't make sense. So part of me held on to the hope that she was still alive. To even like last year, like beginning of last year, I still Googled her name to see, or Facebook checked her name to see if a profile would pop up. You know, I was like, well, maybe, you know, she got sex trafficked or, you know, something that would make sense as to her still being alive, which, you know, that didn't happen. But I found out that the first funeral, she actually wasn't even there. They held her body until the next year, almost a year later. So the reason why it was closed casket was because there was no body.
Was that the sheriff's department?
Yes.
That was who was holding her remains?
Correct.
Had they told the adults that, but the adults had not told you?
I'm not sure.
Between the time of George's disappearance and her funeral, several decisions were made about Angel's future. According to Angel, some local community leaders had interceded on her behalf to get her into a more stable situation.
So at this time, up until, I want to say like April of 98, I was living at a foster home. After my sister's funeral, I think some people from the NAACP felt like I needed to be placed with somebody that could properly love me in that situation. So I went to a foster family, and then later, at the beginning of 98, I moved to Georgia to be with my aunt. And at that time, my mom moved as well. So we both were living together. But we never talked about my sister. It was kind of like a, I don't know, like, honestly, I don't feel like my mom properly grieved during that process. Just over last year, you know, I would share just little things, you know, like things that I've made or things that people have made, and just in how she received it. And, you know, she would just kind of go ghost for a few days. And I knew that it was something that she was still dealing with. You know, it was just so much going on at that time where I don't really think any of us properly grieved, even my brothers, you know. I talked it over with them, and, you know, we've had a lot of crying spells together. And it's like our life was put on hold for those past 23 years in regards to my sister.
Before moving into what Angel knows now as an adult about the investigation, Brooke asked what she remembered from the late 1990s when she was still in Sonoma County.
I'd like to ask you about the investigation at the time. Do you have any memories of talking with law enforcement after this happened? Did they come to talk to you when you were living with your foster mom?
No.
So up until this last year, when you really like dove back in, you had not gotten much or any communication from them?
No, I have called them over the years, but they've never gotten back to me. So, and like I said, I didn't know, like, the process that I'm going through, I didn't know this was a thing. You know, it's like, okay, if they have a job, they're going to do it. So to get that initial phone call and then wait months for a response, it really put into perspective how they don't prioritize what they need to, just to say it nicely. Because we're at a time where we have advancements in technology. You know, you can call somebody on your computer, your phone, you know, anywhere. And with all these advancements, I'm still not getting communication. So if you don't care now, when there's a lot more things to make the job easier, then I can only imagine how they felt 23 years ago when there was more work they had to do.
We asked Angel and Maria, her friend and the family's advocate, how they felt about the current information that's available in the case. For instance, there is one sketch that's been publicly circulated of a man who was seen with Georgia the night of her disappearance. It's worth noting that there is evidence that this sketch resembled not one man, but two. The man that was questioned and possibly cleared by the police, and another person, one we can't name here, who would have had interactions with Georgia.
So from my understanding, the sketch was pretty spot on. One of Georgia's friends felt like she knew who that person was, and she gave a statement to the police. So the sketch was pretty spot on.
So they may have already looked into that individual and eliminated them for whatever reason.
Yeah, so we spoke with the cold case detective that took the over the case in 2001, and he believes that he has already cleared that suspect, but we're not ready to let that be a for sure thing, because even though it is his belief that he may have found and cleared that suspect, we would like to continue to pursue all leads until we know for sure that that sketch is not right. A person that we need to follow.
Right. Well, he said that not necessarily cleared. He just felt like certain things didn't make him the suspect.
Right. It was like more of a gut feeling rather than hard evidence.
Right. Yeah. But from just our own investigation, There have been a lot of suspicious activities that have taken place over the years that only somebody with a guilty conscience would do. So I'm not gonna point a finger at who did what. At this point, I feel like a lot of people have responsibility in my sister's death, from legal aspects down to just being the murderer. And until a specific timeline with this with specific events is identified, I'm not ruling out anybody. Because even when we talked to one of the previous detectives, he said that the sex offender was the primary suspect for a long time.
Tunnel vision.
And in that, you know, I feel like there's certain details that were shared or should have been shared. And if they had investigated properly, they would have, you know, ruled him out. I never felt like he was the one that was responsible. So just knowing how they conduct their investigations, I feel like there's a lot of details that they've missed or overlooked.
Next time on The Fall Line, you'll hear more of Angel's story and George's. How she gained a skill set in the military that's serving her investigation, what she and Maria are working on, and how the hashtag Justice for Georgia Lee Moses is harnessing social media to solve this case. There's so much more to come, so be sure to download next week's episode. In the meantime, you can help Angel's cause by following all of her social media accounts. We've linked them in the show notes. Tag your post about Georgia with Justice for Georgia Lee Moses and Georgia Leah Moses. And most importantly, share what Angel posts. She needs maximum coverage for the work that she's doing. If you have any information regarding the death of Georgia Leah Moses, you can contact the Sonoma County Sheriff's Office at 707-565-2185. If you'd prefer to contact Angel and Maria directly with any information or tips, you can reach them at their Gmail address. It's whathappenedtogeorgialee@gmail.com. That's whatHappenedToGeorgiaLee@gmail.com. Now for our news. We'll be joining in on two fundraisers on February 20th, 2021. First, we're going to join Josh Hallmark, host of True Crime BS, Wine and Crime, Crime Writers On, and many other podcasts in a live podcast-a-thon on Get Vocal to raise money for the Charlie Project. You can get more info on that in the link in our show notes. Second, our friends at Date with Dateline, People Are Wild, and Spooky Kid Podcasts have invited us to join them for a live true crime documentary watch to raise money for the Millbrook Twins Billboard Fund. This will be broadcast via Twitch on the Spooky Kid channel. It's a monthly event called Recap with Friends, and it will begin at 8 p.m. Eastern Time on February 20th. We will be watching the very strange documentary, Tickled. We are really thankful to them for reaching out and offering to help us with the fund. You can find more info via the link in our show notes. Thank you for listening to The Fall Line. As of 2021, The Fall Line is a fully independent show, and we appreciate listener support. It allows us to do research, obtain FOIAs, pay our content advisors, and support and donate to the causes that we care about. If you try out the products that we advertise, please use our sponsor codes. It really helps. And if you'd like to support the show and the stories we cover, join us on Patreon. We're raising Patreon funds to pay the rent on the Millbrook Twins billboard, begin a therapy fund for families who've been on the show, and many other projects. You can read a public post about those goals on our Patreon page. On Patreon, you get early release ad-free versions of our episodes, plus blog posts and videos for only $5 a month. The Fall Line is written, hosted, and researched by Laura Norton, with additional research by Brian Waters, Kim Fritz, and Jessica Ann. Family and law enforcement interviews by Brooke Hargrove. Produced and engineered by Maura Curry. Content advisement by Brandy C. Williams, Liv Fallon, and Vic Kennedy. As always, our most special thanks to Angie Dodd. Currently, our monthly donation is going to the Black and Missing Foundation